I think we're going to do the Namo and the three replicas and five replicas. That's okay? Okay. So anyone who wants to chant some more, you go outside into the garden and chant and chant and chant and chant and chant all morning till lunchtime if you want. Chanting is very good. But it's much nicer to listen to Dharma, to meditate. You can chant any time. The speciality we have in this retreat is meditating, listening to Dharma talks, and eating. Okay, we've got announcements. We've got commercials. What do you want for lunch?
Yeah, that's what the order.
That's already ordered.
Really?
I've already taken care of.
You can ask me.
Really? Again?
What do you want?
Okay, something small.
Huh?
I'm eating too much. You guys are giving me far too much to eat. I get my plate and then you come and give me something else. And out of compassion, I eat it. It's delicious too, I must admit. It's mostly out of compassion. No, I think they're going to get me a tuna or something.
That's what I said yesterday.
Okay. So, now I saw the. Do you see the little elephant this morning? The baby elephant? Had the baby elephant here. If you don't see the baby elephant, have a look at me. It's very funny. Okay, let's do some shouting before we go any further. Okay, so if the charter books are that very simple, just think. You're not doing it in the order in the book, so this is an intelligence test for you to see if you can find it in the book. Start off with Namo. Arahant. Arahant first, then Namo, then five precepts. So here we go. Remember, communal coughing. That's I'm so joking, don't be serious. Here we go. Arahant Sammasambuddho Bhagava Buddham Bhagavanta Abhivadevi. Sokato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhamman Namasami Supatipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sankham Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammā Sambuddhassa. Now the five precepts. Panatipata Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami Adinadana Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami Kamesumi Chajara Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami Musavada Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami Suramiraya Majapamadapana Veramani Sikkhapadam Samadhiyami Sadhu, Sadhu, Sadhu. Okay, that's enough chanting for this morning. Now the Dhamma talk. So if you're sitting comfortably, then I'll begin. That's what I used to say. Now, first of all, we've done a couple of days of meditation already. And some of you, this is the first time you've ever meditated. And sometimes there's people here been meditating a long time. Some people are meditating to get to Nirvana by the end of this retreat, otherwise they're going to ask for their money back. And in the Buddhist fellowship, I always teach this, you've got to be honest. You may always ask for your money back if you're not satisfied with this retreat. You can always ask for your money back. You won't get it, but you're always allowed to ask. But sometimes it's good to know why we're doing this, especially those who are just coming to meditation. And yes, it does lead to the very highest, to ecstasy, to bliss, enormous insight, seeing your past life, all this sort of stuff. Yeah, it does do that. But many of you probably won't take it that far. But at the very least, just doing a little bit of meditation in your life has enormous benefits to increase the quality of your life, increase the success in your career or business, and just basically enhance your health. Meditation has such great benefits in all areas of life. That is one of the reasons it is very, very popular. And I mentioned a few days ago that in our center in Perth, we get referrals from doctors and even dentists who tell the patients who are nervous going to the dentist for surgery or having problems with high blood pressure, with anxiety, panic disorders, whatever, go to the Buddhist monastery, learn some meditation. If that can help you much more than I can, say the doctors. So many areas of your life, it really helps. And there are some students here, and I love telling this story to you, because I learned meditation when I was only about 18 years of age. And even if I never became a monk, it was one of the greatest things I ever did, especially to be able to pass my exams. And this gives you an understanding of why we meditate this way and how it works in ordinary life. Because this was the story of my final exams at Cambridge University in 1972, Natural Sciences, Theoretical Physics. Now that was, what was it, 40 years ago now? Exactly 40 years ago. Amazing. Anniversary. Anyway. Actually, May probably was about this time as well. May? No, actually a bit earlier. By end of May, June, yeah, about 40 years ago, this story happened. But anyway, in those days, everything depended upon one series of examinations. Everything you've done in the whole university career, good or bad, counted for nothing, zip, zero. And everything was down to one set of examinations. And they were held in Natural Sciences Theoretical Physics over 6 days, starting on Monday, on Tuesday, on Wednesday, on Thursday, on Friday, and even Saturday, 6 days in a row. 3 hour paper in the morning, 1 hour for lunch, a 3 hour paper in the afternoon, all in a row. Now that was very, very stressful, as you can imagine. Especially, because you guys are still at school at university, you really get the pressure put on you by your parents. Come on! This is important. This is university entrance. This is, I don't know, whatever exams you do, O levels or A levels. If you do that right, if you do it well, then you'll be set in life. And listen, guys and girls, that's what they told me. You do well in your final examinations, and then you'll be set for life. And now look at me. I tell a lot of people, if only I had known. If only I could have predicted and seen my future, I was going to become a monk. I wouldn't have needed to study so hard. But if you're not going to become a monk, you guys and girls, you'd better study. If you want to become a monk, okay, you can fail. Join my monastery or go join a nunnery, cut off your hair. But otherwise, you better study. But I had advantage over all the other students in theoretical physics because I had learned how to meditate. Pretty similar to the method I've been teaching you over the last couple of days. And this is what happened. After the first examination in the morning, 9 o'clock till 12, then I went for lunch. Actually, we had an hour for lunch, but I never had lunch. The afternoon examination is going to start at 1 o'clock, finish till 4. So I went back to my room. I had a very big breakfast. I had no lunch. I was going to have dinner. Instead, I went to my room, sat down and meditated to de-stress. For those of you who've done examinations, you know how stressful it can be, especially when you think your life depends upon it. So I went back to my room, sat on my meditation cushion, and to relax. And the first thing which came up into my mind, as you would probably expect, was thinking about that morning exam. How had I done? Had I answered the questions correctly? Could I have added more explanation? I started to think about that morning examination, even though I was logical. I knew that examination had already been completed. The papers were in the examiner's hands. Right or wrong, it could not be changed. So it was a waste of time thinking about it. We all know that. But how many of you can do that? To let it go. It does take training. You can't just rely on reason and logic and think, okay, it's all done, it's finished, I don't need to think about it. You still start thinking about it, don't you? But with a little bit of training, letting go of the past, for a couple of years before then, I could very easily follow that logic to its conclusion and totally let go of the morning exam. And of course, as soon as I let go of the past, which for me was a morning examination, the next thing which came into my mind was the afternoon exam. Should I get out of meditation, do some last minute revision to study? And I realized that no, it's a waste of time revising. The best thing I can do for that afternoon examination is to rest, to prepare my mind. I've already studied enough, I've been to enough lectures and tutorials. All the information was in there. All I needed to do now was to relax, to prepare my brain to perform in the afternoon. And very easy for us to have that again reason, the logic. It's a waste of time thinking about the future. What you really need to do is to relax. Now is the time your future is being made. This is the only time you can do anything about your future. Right now, the most important thing to do is to relax if you're going to have to perform in a stressful situation. We all know that. But can you do it? And that's the thing again with the training. Because I've been meditating for a couple of years, I could do that very easily. I trained myself to be able to let go of the future, noticing how important it was to be in the present. So all this meditation, yes, you can understand it, but you have to practice, practice, practice until you can do these things. Until when it really is necessary, you can let go of the past and let go of the future and just rest in the present moment. It does take practice like anything else. Now, as soon as I was in the present moment, that's when I had a shock. You know that sometimes you talk about insight. And sometimes people think insights are very amazing understandings about the nature of reality in the world, but some of the most useful insights are just ordinary things, which if you can see them, can change your life. What I saw, which I never expected to see, was my body shaking. I never considered myself to be a nervous person, but you could understand that this was an extremely high-stress situation. Examinations at university, Cambridge, final year examinations. For a reason I was shocked, I hadn't seen that. I hadn't noticed it. Because I'd been so busy studying or doing the examinations. I had paid no attention at all to my body. and I never noticed it was actually physically shaking, out of fear, out of anxiety. Many of you have anxiety attacks. Actually, they're not just sudden attacks, that's when the anxiety which has been there a long time actually is so strong you can't ignore it anymore. But what for me was surprising, it was there. And I never thought of myself as an anxious person. It's understandable, it's okay to be anxious at such a situation. But as soon as I saw it, then I could do something about it. You know what it's like if you don't identify the problem, the problem's going to stay there for a long time. Once you see it, it's easy to deal with. So once I could see my body shaking, it's very easy to relax it, to relax it, to relax it. And again, the way to relax your body, again, is what we've taught already. You're mindful, you can see the body shaking. But that mindfulness gives me feedback. The shaking gets more or gets less, and the mindfulness can notice that, and the mindfulness can connect what I need to do to make it less. When you have feedback given by mindfulness, it becomes very easy to relax your own body. You can feel it when it gets tense, you can feel it when it gets loose. And you can see the connection. If you're afraid, anxious, controlling, it all tenses up. When you're calm, when you let go, when you're content, the body moves to another state which mindfulness recognizes as greater relaxation. The mindfulness gives you feedback and teaches you what you need to do to relax. You know what you need to do? It's called compassion. This is actually you learn what compassion really is to your own body. It's okay to talk about it. You may give a long description and write a book about compassion. But when you actually see that that particular attitude of mind, which changes the feelings in the body to more relaxation, and you notice that through your mindfulness, that is what compassion is. It's an experience. So that's what I did. And you can relax the whole body until the shaking stopped. That's so important to do, to get rid of that anxiety and nerves. Because you all know when you are ever in a stressful situation, whether it's an examination, an interview for a job, going to the doctor to see the results of your biopsy, going and talking to this really hot chick, or this really sort of hot guy you really want to go out with, that nervousness, that anxiety screws everything up. You keep failing. So to be able to control that shaking, to let it go and get this beautiful bodily state of ease is a wonderful trick to be able to do. So my body can actually relax before the afternoon examination. And the next layer of problems which I encountered was one which is the cause of much anger, depression and failure in life. Because when I got beyond the physical, my body relaxed, I looked at my mind. It was so tired. It was exhausted, it was drained. As makes common sense. For 3 hours, I've been asking these toughest of questions. You know, one of the best universities, on one of the hardest subjects, of the university, theoretical physics. They were tough questions, and I was really pushing my brain to get the best answers. This was highly competitive. So no wonder my brain was tired. It was exhausted. And the thing was, I never noticed how tired a person's brain can become. And when it does become tired, that is the main reason you get angry at other people. You get upset at yourself. It's just a reaction to the deep tiredness inside your brain. It also has many health problems as well. And all I needed to do was to notice that, how tired the brain was, and just leave it alone, to rest it. Just like everything else, once you rest the body, the rest the mind, then it gets energized again. That's why you go to bed at night, have a good rest. You may be really tired, wiped out after the end of a busy day. You get up in the morning, you're rested, you feel bright, energetic, ready to sort of rock and roll, as we used to say. And so once you are ready to rock and roll, you can achieve. And that's what happened to me. My brain was so tired and exhausted. All I needed to do is to rest it. To be still. That's how you rest. If you want to rest very deeply, be very deeply still. I could train myself to do that, and for 2 or 3 years I've been meditating. I became so still, you just observe all the energy come back into your brain. It was like it was filled up with gas. It was, you know, like your mobile phone which had run out of power, you plug them in, and now you get the indicator saying it's fully charged again. That was my brain. It was fully changed again. See what I said, talk about mobile phones and made a new one. Sorry, it's my fault. It was fully charged. So when I came out of only half an hour's meditation, that was all it was. I was basically refreshed, energized, and ready to sort of do that examination in the afternoon. There's no anxiety, no fear, fully recharged. And it was, I only found this out afterwards, maybe you know, a year or two afterwards, when you met up with your old friends. And they said, yeah, we know this, Jude. Now, you were the only student, they said this, and I think it was probably true, the only student who went into the afternoon examination smiling. Everyone else was terrified. And I had this big smile on my face. And some of them thought I'd be cheating. I thought they said, you know, you found out the answer somewhere, that's why you're smiling. I wasn't cheating. I suppose it was in a way cheating. I was doing something that other people didn't know how to do. To prepare my brain and my body for a stressful afternoon. That's why I did really well. Now I love telling that story because it shows this meditation, yeah, it's religious, it's Buddhist, it's spiritual, you get these amazing experiences, but it's also for the practical benefits of your life. You guys who are going to go to a university, you haven't done your O levels and A levels yet, please, for goodness sake, make use of this meditation. It's an incredibly powerful examination technique. You will get higher grades. You will perform much better, which means your parents don't scold you as much as they do now. You have a much easier life. It's really worth it to get them off your back by getting high marks. And it's easy to do, just learning a bit of meditation. And later on in your life, even if you're playing sports, there are many sports personalities now meditate because, again, if you're going to play in a big match, again, imagine the anxiety and the nerves before you go out onto that big stadium. You can just meditate a little while. Your body relaxes, your mind relaxes, which means you perform to your highest ability. If you get nervous, you always stuff up and fail and lose. And I know that some sports people, they make stupid mistakes. How on earth can you make that mistake? If you're relaxed and just playing for fun, you would never make that mistake. But because of anxiety and nerves, that is why you keep failing. So this little bit of meditation stops all of that. And even in your work life, when you have to go to an interview or something, sometimes you're waiting in that room, waiting for the boss to call you in or waiting for the interview. For goodness sake, learn how to relax. Do a tiny bit of meditation, it's only 5 minutes. Then you can do that. You find you're so relaxed, clear. You come out as this incredibly highly confident young woman or young man. And that really impresses the bosses. You're clear, relaxed. The confidence is just telling the boss, not by words, but by your body language, I can do it. And that's what the boss wants to find out. And in anything else in life, the ability to let go of the past and let go of the future. How many people are consumed by these things which happened earlier today, or last week, or last year, in the prison of their past unfortunate experience? Psychologists have to spend so much time with people in order for them to let go, because you broke up with somebody years ago, or your husband slept with your best friend, or something else terrible happened in your life. That consumes you. Okay, you failed once, but if you keep on thinking about that failure, you never succeed in the future. If you can let it go, then you can start again with no baggage. But how many people can really start again? They just carry far too much baggage because, again, they don't know how to let go of the past. In meditation, you're practicing this every time you meditate. You learn how to do this. So you become a person who, when you have to go to your father's funeral, or maybe the death of some other loved one, you can be there, and you can be this incredible strong rock, like a lighthouse of wisdom on top of that rock, which makes sure that no one else gets shipwrecked on the griefs, on the rocks of grief and tragedy. And I know many people have done that. One of my monks, who's just going to be coming back in a couple of weeks' time, he's been overseas. He went, he's a Norwegian monk, might have been a Mali, another one. His family were never all that happy with him becoming a monk. They had other things they wanted him to do in life. But you know, he was mature, he had done his job, he was a manager of some company somewhere, still in his 20s. Very, very smart guy. And he wanted to become a monk, so they couldn't stop him, so he became a monk, but they never really approved until his father died. When his father died, suddenly he flew straight back to Norway to look after his family and also to perform the most important part of the funeral service. And I got a letter back from his brother, the elder brother of the family, saying, look, I don't know what you guys have been doing over there in Australia. Whatever it is, it's very wonderful. My younger brother, your monk, has been such an inspiration, such a strength for the whole family. I just wanted to write to say thank you, Ajahn Mahal, for teaching my brother. And to tell you the whole family is so proud that he's a monk. Thank you so much. They saw the result of someone who's actually trained in wisdom, in meditation, who did let go. It really counted when they needed someone who was strong and wise and kind. He was that person. I don't know if you have been in tragedies of close friend commit suicide, or just jump off the balcony, or if you've been in that situation when someone has suddenly had another type of tragedy. How does it affect you? Could you let it go, let go of the fear of the future, and live in the moment? And be kind. This is where you train how to do that. Right here, through meditation. Which is why the meditation becomes such a popular thing. Because my goodness, it does work. I don't know how many of you have got health problems. I've mentioned that story of that guy with psoriasis all over his body. There's so many other cases of people who've had very bad sicknesses. I told you in an interview about this one man in a meditation retreat I gave in Sydney some years ago. He had a tumour on his nasal passage, sinus cancer or something, and his doctors had given up on him. Nothing more we can do. You're going to die, prepare yourself and settle your affairs. And he decided to try meditation as a last resort. It's a shame that they used it as a last resort. It should be the first resort. Then you wouldn't mess up your body with so much chemotherapy and radiation therapy and surgery and all this sort of stuff. So he came to my retreat. And at that retreat, there was the first night there was a question. And the question is, can you please ask people to breathe quietly on this retreat? Because this guy was making such a noise. Throughout the whole time. Because his nose was totally blocked by this cancerous tumour. And so when I told everybody, I should have made the announcement at the beginning, that noise is being made by a man who's dying. He's maybe only gone a couple of months at most. And he's dying of nasal cancer. That's why it's making that noise. And as soon as I said that, there were no more complaints. But look, if somebody makes a noise in this retreat, it must mean they're dying of something or other. Give it a break. Don't get angry at them. So I taught in the meditation exactly the same meditation as I've been teaching you. But it's not working. It's just too late. He left it to the very, very last. He should have done it much earlier. But there was one tiny breakthrough at the last day of this 9-day retreat. Because as we were leaving, you know, the interviews were all over, but he came up to me and said, "Look, something happened, I've got to tell you." So what is it? He said, "This morning when I was meditating on the last day, I was meditating as usual, getting nowhere, but then I heard a pop." So he said, "A pop." And he said he could breathe again. Air was going up through his nostrils. But it only lasted a minute or such before the tumour closed in again. But that was a miracle. No, because it's not imagination, tumours shrinking or growing. He knew it had shrunk because he could feel the air going up his own nose. Hadn't done that for months. So that was very encouraging. But I must admit, when I left, I thought the guy left it too late. He's going to die. Because he can't just suddenly change his tumour just with one meditation retreat. It was about 2 or 3 years later, I was giving another talk in another place in Sydney, and this guy came up to me and he said, "Do you remember me?" Look, it was really a bad question to ask, because when you've got cancer, you're really thin, you're all bones, you're wasting away, and that's what he looked like the last time I saw him. Now he was like fit and healthy, you know, full of muscle, looked really, really strong, looked very well. He said, "I was that guy." He said, "I carried on doing your meditation. The tumour shrunk totally away. I've been feeling full recession, not recession, that's the way economy is. I've been reading too many papers. Regression. Remission. Okay, that's the right way. Sorry for me, an issue to me. Full recession. Full remission," he said, "and I'm spending the rest of my life, however many years I'm given, to teach other people how to meditate." That was the meaning of his life, because it saved his life. He just wanted to come and say thank you. I couldn't recognize the guy. Quite honestly, no one would be able to. He looked totally different. Didn't work. Now that's one case out of hundreds. So look, if you really get this meditation together, your health improves. That is why it's worth doing. So it's not just, okay, I'm going to meditate to become enlightened. No, you're going to meditate to get your examinations a higher grade with not much work, to get all the stress out of your life, so that, you know, if you're still looking for a partner, you never feel anxious, you go and see somebody you like, just go and say, "Hey, I like you very much. Are you single?" Whatever it is, you don't have any fear. And that you come across as really confident when you sort of give a chance at your work, you take it, you're efficient with the use of your brain, you're healthy. This is one of the best medicines ever, and you get it here for cut price. So actually, I don't mind saying this, but you know, one of the best teachers around. So you know, you've got this incredible good opportunity, so don't waste it. So that motivates you, but remember the instructions for goodness sake. It's very, very simple. If you're going to relax and become healthy, let go of anxiety and fear. You're going to be able to let go enough to prepare yourself for what's coming next in the afternoon or evening, whenever you have some stressful situation in front of you. You have to let go of the past and future. You have to stop thinking and worrying about all this stuff, and just be peaceful, to be still, to have peace of mind. It's a wonderful word. So much so that people actually look upon that as one of the goals of life, to find peace of mind. And you find it right here, in this moment, in this body, right where you're sitting. Peace of mind. It won't last forever, peace of mind, because then you have to go to work. That's called compassion, kindness, doing your duties. Whenever you want peace of mind, it's just there for you. Just sitting down, maybe in the train going to work in the morning, sitting down, closing your eyes, and just being here. Not going to your destination, not leaving from where you come from, just being exactly where you are, making peace with it, not fighting. You can fight later on, just being at peace with your body, being at peace with your mind, being kind, relaxing. And you find that mindfulness will show you that your mind goes more and more and more peaceful. You understand what causes peace in the mind. The goal of meditation, peace of mind. And you find again that setting home, that being kind, putting things down, passively just watching. For being so kind, you never criticize your mind. As many of you have known me for a long, long time, many of you have come and told me your problems, and sometimes you make big mistakes. Sometimes people come and say, look, I haven't been meditating all week, and I've broken my precepts, I had a glass of wine in my room last night. But when they come and confess these things, I always give the same response. I say, very good. So much so that my monks say, Ajahn Prabhu, you don't need to do those interviews anymore. We can do them for you. Because we always just say the same thing you do. Someone says, I've just come and murdered the person in my room. And they'll say, very good. Now you see me do that in those of you who've been on retreats and come to interviews. How many times do I say, very good, even though you misbehave and be naughty? The reason is because I refuse to judge you. I refuse to criticize you. But I insist on respecting you. I don't know why you killed a person in the same room as you. You must have had some reason, so very good. So you're never going to do that. But you can see just how non-judgmental that is. And that's why people aren't afraid to come to interviews with me. They can tell anything and they'll be respected and cared for. Never ever scolding. Some of you have known me a long time. How is there anyone in this room who I've ever scolded? Be honest, put your hand up. Have I ever scolded you? Have I scolded you doing it? Look, Paul, have I ever scolded you? Even for falling asleep, do you like that? Google, very good. And I do that on purpose because I don't want you to scold yourself when you're meditating. You fall asleep when you're meditating. Totally fall asleep. When you wake up afterwards, please tell yourself, very good. You thought the weirdest and kinkiest sexual fantasies during the meditation. And after you come out, oh my goodness, you should tell yourself, very good. Because then you are making peace with yourself. And the strange thing happens is, no, it's not encouraging sort of, you know, the weird stuff in the mind. It's not encouraging sleepiness. Kindness. Acceptance, making peace, is good karma. You never get bad results from good karma. But if you're kind, if you're gentle, if you're forgiving, especially of yourself, then you're going to get some incredibly deep meditation. You are going to relax at last. When you scold yourself, you tense up. When people praise you, you're such a wonderful meditator. As a teacher, I'm so privileged to have you to teach during these few days. I think, you relax. You bunch of scallywags! I don't know why I teach you a hopeless lot. I might as well teach a bunch of worms rather than teach you guys. And then you get depressed. But no, I never will do something like that. Because if I do that to you, you do it to yourself. And your meditation gets so stressful and fearful, and you never enjoy peace of mind. So relax. Don't judge yourself. At the end of every meditation, tell yourself, very good. No matter what you do to me. And that way you find a way to find peace of mind. It's not through struggle, it's through acceptance. Not through fighting, it's through peace. Not through hatred and control. It's through this beautiful sense of love and embracing every moment for what it is. And eventually, you stay here long enough, or you listen to enough of my tapes, you will soon get brainwashed. And it works. You really relax and become a much more peaceful person, a healthier person, a more successful person, And also you'll find good people like you want. Who likes to be with someone who's always angry and sorry? And who likes to be with someone who always respects you, who always understands you, is kind to you? So that's really how it all works. So when you're meditating, please always say very good. Embrace this moment, appreciate it, and respect it, no matter what it is. If it's kindness, if it's anxiety, whatever, it's here to teach you. And welcome all the lessons of life. And when you welcome everything, eventually your mind is so peaceful, so kind. The peace and kindness comes in. And it's great to you. You just sit here, just a happy little being. You're sitting here, just watching the breath come in. The breath, not wanting anything in the whole world. Perfectly at peace with yourself. Not wanting charms or ministers or anything. Just being happy to be here. Be free of desire. Just like that big child in the wishing room. I wish I'm so content, I don't need any more desire. I don't want enlightenment. I don't want charms. I don't want innocence. I don't want insights. I'm just happy being here. And that becomes the battle. That's where all these things happen. I know people, they ask me, and they keep asking me, can you please describe these dharmas in more detail? No, I won't. Just let go and make peace, and they'll come to you. I don't want to sort of create more craving and desires, because that will just put off their arrival for maybe years. Just be content, be peaceful, be still, be really relaxed. And all those darkness, they just appear. That's the beauty of this path. As it said in the Rasudhi Magga, one of the great Buddhist texts, the path is that no traveller on it is seen. Ajahn Brahm has to disappear before Dharma comes. You, the traveller, have to learn. But all these wonderful things just come to you. Oh, as Ajahn Chah used to say in the first year I was with him, he said his monastery in the northeast of Thailand was a mango orchard. And the mango trees had been planted by the Buddha himself. And he said those mango trees were so mature, they were so dripping, he said, with thousands of ripe, juicy, sweet mangoes. That's what he said. And I thought, that guy's really crazy. There's no mango trees in that monastery. And even if there were, they certainly were not planted by the Buddha. That was too long ago. He never came to Thailand. So it was his sinner. But then he went even more weird. He said, because of the Buddha's great wisdom and compassion, he said, you monks these days don't need to climb the tree to get a mango. You don't need to shake the tree to get it to fall. You don't need to take a stick and throw it at the branches to get the mangoes down. Because of the great wisdom and compassion of the Buddha, all you need to do, monks, and now that's nuns, all the people here, men and women, no matter if you're monks or not, this is all you need to do to get a mango. To sit under the tree and hold out your hand, and a mango will fall. That's all you need to do. And I thought, that is really crazy. I should leave this place. You've got this mentally deranged abbot teaching weird stuff. I actually thought that at the time, and I just fired it away as something which was stupid. But I always remembered those sayings. And later on in my monastic life, when I meditated more and more deeply, I thought, wow, that is so accurate. What Ajahn Chah used to say. All those fruits of meditation, nimittas, jhanas, peace, bliss, ecstasy, insights, they're like the mangoes on that tree. But if you try and climb that tree or shake it or throw something up on it, a mango will never fall. You will never get peace, you will never get charms, you will never get any insight, you won't get any enlightenment at all if you shake the tree, climb up it or throw things at it. Instead, what Ajahn Chah said, what the Buddha said, what I say now, make it very, very strong. If you want to get jhana, just sit quietly, hold out your hand, and the jhana will fall into it. That's all you do. Basically, be still. And the jhana does not fall on top of your head. It falls right in your hand. That's how wonderful these teachings are. You sit there, do absolutely nothing. Just relaxing, making peace. Just watching your breath, if that's what you have to be doing. Breath disappears, you don't do anything. Beautiful image that comes up, it comes right to you. You don't do anything, you don't mess around with it. And then it says those blossoms in these amazing charms, they just come to you. The wonderful thing about this path, when you let go, it's still and peaceful. Amazing things happen, which do literally blow your mind. And now you really understand what Buddhism is and how it was taught. Why? Not just meditation, but the whole teachings of Buddhism. The emptiness, the non-self, the teachings of the Four Noble Truths, craving, wanting, leads to suffering, many go leads to the Nirvana. This being peace, stopping doing things, stillness. The teaching to Anguri Mara, stop Anguri Mara. Anguri Mara understood that. That was from the time of the Buddha. He stopped. He didn't do things. He really did stop. Big time. Stop. That's when all these amazing things happened. He became an arahant very quickly. Many people do that. You struggle and strive, you just go out of circles. You just sit out of the tree, hold out your hand, and wait. And all the wonderful things happen. The beauty, the profundity of meditation. So you may see that even for 3 days I haven't told you what to do. I'll give you some instructions. Am I supposed to watch the breath? How am I supposed to watch the breath? If this happens, what should I do next? All of those questions I have actually answered. That's meditating in the wrong way. It has nothing to do with what's happening next. If ever that thought comes up in your mind, what should I do next? The alarms should ring. The red flag should come up. You've lost the present moment. You're thinking about next. It's all about now. And if you get upset with now, another alarm bell, another red flag. Embrace this moment. Don't judge it. Stay to this moment. And if you do that, you are actually doing nothing, sitting under the tree. Mangoes fall one after the other, the sweetest and juiciest fruits you could ever imagine. That is the path, and that's how it works. Which is why anybody could do that, if you don't do anything. If it really took great effort, I would never be able to get anywhere, because I'm a lazy monk. Are you a lazy person? Yeah. So if you're lazy too, then you can become enlightened. If you're a workaholic, you're no way. So relax and enjoy. And just like room service, they come to your room and say, somebody has sent some tea to you, Ajahn Brahm. Oh, thank you very much. I never ordered it. I don't even have to pay for it. It just comes. Just like nimittas and jhanas, I don't order it. So the girls come and say, here, Japan, someone's ordered you some first jhana. Okay, thank you very much, I'll have that. It's called Buddhist room service. And that's how it works. Okay, so that's the talk for this morning. Before we have tea break, I'll do any questions from the floor, from here, or from the chair? Because it's not just floor, some of you sitting on the chairs. Any questions about this so far? Don't try and remember it, it just soaks in after a while. Okay, a couple of questions from the box until we get to 9 o'clock, then we have 12 o'clock. Have you heard from other meditators who can recall their past life? What is hell like? Usually what happens, if you're a meditator, remember their past life, you usually got pretty good karma. So it's usually the people who go to hell are not the sort of people who have enough good karma to remember their past lives, thank goodness. But I do have some experience of hell, because I was teaching a retreat in Penang a few years ago. And the retreat I teach in Penang is usually every other year, and it's over the Christmas holidays, so no one, people have time off. And so it was, I've been teaching and giving the evening talk, and you know, questions and photographs and signing books. It was about 10:30 or 11 o'clock when I got back to my room to go to rest. We're getting up 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning, so I needed my beauty, no, not beauty sleep anymore, but you know what I mean. I needed some rest, and I was really tired, so I got back there. Because it was Christmas, on the opposite side of the road, they held a Christmas party, and they decided it would be a karaoke party. By this time, they're mostly, you know, they're not quite drunk yet, but, you know, 90%. So they started singing with the karaoke. And when you're drunk, you think that you can sing like Frank Sinatra. But you sound more like that elephant this morning. And it was terrible. And they were doing this at the top of their voices. And I just could not get to sleep at all. I don't mind music, but karaoke music, out of tune, out of song, forgetting the words, really loud. And I realized that that is one of the hell realms. The karaoke hell. And you've got other hells where you're boiled alive or have to go up razor trees and all that stuff. I could take that, but karaoke hell, no, please. It is anything but karaoke hell. And it taught me about 1 o'clock at last they stopped. But you know, it's terrible stuff, karaoke. If you're part of it and you're drunk too, you don't know what's going on, so it's okay. But if you happen to be a neighbour, that's the worst punishment ever to inflict on your neighbours. Having a karaoke party. That's what hell is like. So anyway, the next question.
Here we go.
My husband has been using your teachings to put me down. How can he do that? He can be saying to you, wife, you're good enough. You're cooking very good. That's not my teachings. I completely disavow this. I'm going to get my lawyer. Anyway, my husband's been busy, your teachings put me down. You are not compassionate. That's not being compassionate to say you're not compassionate. So your husband is not understanding my teachings. You don't say you're not compassionate. You say you're good enough. You're kind enough. Very good. Wish you were kind and gentle. And you say, oh, never mind, husband. Stroke his head. Don't punch his head, but stroke it. Yeah, good. But you all know that story of mine. Remind him of the story, I'd only say it in brief, because most of you should know this by now, of the husband who went to the market for eggs. And he was abused by a crazy guy. He was so upset, he came back home, and his wife said, you're back early, darling. Have you got the eggs? He said, no, because this young man came up and abused me and scolded me and said terrible things about me and kept putting me down. And the wife said, oh, it's him. He's a crazy boy. He hit his head. He's brain damaged. And the poor boy would never be able to go to school, never find a wife, never get a job. He's crazy. He just hangs around the market scolding people. Now, you wouldn't believe some of the things he said about me. Just anybody. He just scolds them, calls them all sorts of bad names. Because he's brain damaged, he hit his head. And as soon as the husband realized that the guy abusing him was brain damaged, it didn't matter anymore. You know, if a crazy person starts calling you a pig or stupid or ugly, you don't mind that because the poor boy is crazy. So she said, I still need those eggs. He went back to the market, got the eggs for her, got scolded all the way there, all the way back, but it didn't matter anymore. She knew the guy was crazy. And the moral of that story If your husband did something this, so you are not compassionate, wish you were quite insensitive. Just tell your husband, remember I told our story about the guy who went to go to get the eggs and was scolding. He said, you must have hit your head today, husband. you've got brain damage. Certainly insanity. There's no other reason why you scold anybody. So tell him that story, that will sort of overturn what he says. It strains our relationship, it makes me wonder why he married an evil woman in the first place, and why he married a man who thinks so lousy of me. It's a good thing to remember, why did you marry that guy? And it's a very wonderful reason. So. You know, you saw something in him which was very kind and very beautiful and very caring. That is still there. It didn't change. So remember why you married him. When you see that, what you see in another person is what they show you back. If you see all their faults, all their anger, all their stupidity, that's what you see in your husband. He keeps on showing you back. That's that story when I went to prisons to teach. I would never see the violence of those men in those jails, the way they'd abused women or abused other people. I would not look at that at all. I saw the beauty in these guys, their kindness and their humanity. When I saw that, that's what they showed me back. We had a wonderful time here. If you see the murder, they get violent towards you too. Well, you see another person is what they show you back. Please remember that. That's a very, very powerful teaching. So if you see in your husband all that negativity, he's going to show it to you back and get angry at you. So you remember why you married that guy. Remember that when you next face him. See that in him, he's still there, and he will show it to you back. Your relationship changes. Please advise what a couple needs to do to maintain this relationship and not get on each other's nerves. Thank you. Yes, great relationships, because it really tests you. Most of you fail miserably. But some of you are wise enough to take these teachings to heart. And once a year, as I keep telling people, on your anniversary, every time I do a marriage blessing, I insist that the couple always do this on their anniversary. Exchange gifts, doesn't matter who's first. And maybe the husband starts first, 1 year the wife starts first, the other year. The husband says to that wife, after giving her a little token gift, "Darling, if there's anything which I have said, or done, or thought, on purpose or just by mistake, which has irritated you, or even hurt you, I'm sure there's been many things. I apologize, I'm sorry. I really mean it. I'm a human being, I'm trying my best. Please forgive me. Or if there's things I should have done, which I didn't do, please forgive me. I mean it." And as, say, the wife, you don't say, "Yes, about time. Here's the list." No, don't spoil it. You give that forgiveness that means of high respect and deserves it. Thank you. Yes, I forgive you. I mean it. You've asked to be forgiven. If anyone does that, you must always give forgiveness, 100%. And then, if you're so, you say to your husband, "Darling, what I have done in the past year, said or just thought, on purpose or just by mistake, which has really hurt you or irritated you, made your life more difficult, or things that I forgot to do which I should have done, please forgive me." And then the husband said, "Yes, I forgive." And then embrace. It's by reasserting your marriage vows, accepting that both of you are not perfect, that you do make mistakes, you will make mistakes, but acknowledging those mistakes, being forgiven, is just a wonderful way of reasserting the primacy of your life. What's really important. Then you have a happy life together. Otherwise, these little irritating things, they keep staying there year after year after year after year. And then we think, why would I ever marry that girl? The cancer has grown, the tumor is so big, you can't see any redeeming qualities in the other person. So please, I insist that people I give marriage blessings for, they promise me they'll do that every year. It keeps marriages together. Let's go for goodness. Okay, so now I'm going to please forgive me because I've gone on for too long again. And if there's anything I've done to your flatter by irritating it by talking too long, please ask forgiveness. And now I'm going to make amends by giving everybody toilet breaks.